I'll tell a story here that dates from 1977. I can't remember the exact date, but it was autumn. I'm an old man now, sometimes forgetful. My daughter says she's worried, tells me I'm starting to repeat things. That is why I write this story down for the first and last time, hoping to preserve it, because it's too extraordinary to just fade away, like my sanity. I write this down now because I'm still sharp enough to remember most of the details of the experience that changed my life forever. I don't like to think about it, but for some reason I need to put it on paper. So here goes. In the 70s, I worked as a location scout for Warner Brothers. An excellent job, I can assure you. It paid well, and travelling at the expense of your boss is something a lot of people can only dream of. I have always loved to see new places, and thanks to my job, I was allowed to travel to the farthest corners of the world in search of suitable locations for major motion pictures. I had been asked to find a suitable location for a low-budget drama about a struggling writer who goes on a retreat in a town and falls in love with a local waitress. Nothing original, I thought, but the movie, called Yellow Leaves, would turn out to become a sleeper hit over time. It would reignite the career of a fading movie star, whose name I can't recall at the moment. I hope I'm not losing my mind before I write all of this down. Anyway, my eyes fell on San Luis, a small Californian village about 40 miles from San Francisco. I accidentally stumbled upon the village when it was mentioned in a vintage travel brochure I'd dug up from my archives. I used old travel flyers quite often, because sometimes they mentioned places that used to be popular tourist attractions, but over the course of time had lost their spark, for whatever reason. I didn't find much when I did some quick research on the village. In those days, you couldn't simply Google a place. You actually had to visit an archive or go to a library to get a sense of what a town actually looked like. Unfortunately, recent information on the place was sparse, but of course that was not unusual for sleepy towns with under 1,000 residents. I finally found some information about the history of the village in a dusty book about the Californian coastline, dating from the 50s. It named a diner called Ann's Lobster Lobby, and a large bronze sculpture that was placed in the town's central square to honour the 8 fishermen who had died at sea in a storm only a few years after World War I had ended. I remember that words like rustic and picturesque were used to describe San Luis. Given that the movie was set in the 1960s, I was looking for a place where time had stood still, and I decided to give it a shot. A clear picture of the mayor was shown in the book. He seemed like a decent fellow, with a remarkably slick haircut and a sharp nose, distinctive features. I looked up his name in the phone book and found his number quickly. I called him to gather some more information on the town. It wasn't until my third call that afternoon that he finally picked up the phone. He sounded old and spoke slowly, in a friendly but authoritarian way. I pictured that guy from that movie Koch when I heard his voice. An old-fashioned type of guy, kind-hearted but firm in his beliefs, a classic American old-timer. I asked him if I could drop by the following week to discuss the possibilities of shooting a movie in his town. I tried to sell him my usual crap about the town's economic benefits of filming on location. A few months of filming meant a lot of money for local businesses, and a movie would guarantee an increase in tourist numbers, and so on. But he didn't really seem to care at all. But he said that a meeting was definitely possible, and he could even give me a personal tour of the town, if that would please me. Of course, I didn't let that offer pass me by, and I immediately asked him when he would be available. In his calm manner, he told me that he preferred a specific day, especially because there were some festivities planned for San Luis that day. Festivities, that's what he called it. And I even think that he put emphasis on the word, although that may be something I've made up over the years. Like I said earlier, my mind is not what it used to be. I asked him what sort of festivities he was talking about, but he told me he would prefer to keep that a surprise. I agreed all the same. I was happy. It never hurt to have the mayor by your side if you wanted to shoot on location. I booked a ticket and left for San Francisco on a drizzly Friday morning. I rented a car from the airport and drove to San Luis using a map. I remember I was surprised by the fact that the weather was exactly the same on the west coast. My windshield wipers rhythmically moved back and forth as I drove the long way to San Luis. On the way, I stopped at a diner for a quick bite, and while I waited for my meal, I stared at the rain which splashed violently on the roof of my green Chevrolet. A friendly young girl with red lips served me pancakes, and after some small talk, she asked me where I was headed. "San Luis," I said. "Do you know it?"
"I don't really know San Luis," she admitted, "but I have heard a few things about it."
She spoke with a deep voice, but she still had the soft features and the blushed cheeks of a teenager. I figured she couldn't have been older than 18. I asked her what she had heard about San Luis. She blushed and said that everything she had heard was probably nonsense.
"Still, I'd like to know," I said, intrigued by her now, and not just because of her disarming youthful appearance. "Well, it's said that people have become strictly religious over there in the last few years. That's all I know."
"Fanatically, you mean?" I asked.
"Yep, strict believers. The sort of folk that take the Bible too literally, I guess. My father told me to steer clear of the town, that he didn't want me to go there. Not that I have any reason to go there anyway, but still, he was really clear about it."
She bit her lip for a moment, and I almost saw a light go on in her head.
"So, are you actually going there now, sir?"
"That's right. What's your name, miss?" She smiled and pointed at her name tag, which said Molly. "That's right, Molly."
"Well, at least you know what you can expect in that town now. Are you a devoted Christian, sir?"
I laughed and assured her I wasn't. Quite the contrary, in fact. I told her about my work, and that seemed to reassure her. She asked how long I was going to stay, and I said that my plan was to return to San Francisco tomorrow, or maybe the day after. She told me about her plans to study in the city. She whispered to me that wanting to get out of town was the main reason she worked at the diner. She said she was waiting tables to earn enough money for her studies.
"I'm excited at the idea of leaving. I'm bored here," she said, staring out of the window,
her blue eyes suddenly losing their life a little as she stared at the street outside.
"Something is not right here. Time passes too slowly."
She looked at me and smiled shyly.
"You most probably think I'm crazy," she said, blushing.
"No," I said, "I don't think you are." I smoked a cigarette and tipped Molly big time before I headed out. She thanked me twice and returned to the counter. I opened the door, and the deafening sound of the pouring rain came in. I couldn't hear the tinkling of the doorbell through the sound of the thunder. Molly called after me.
"Would you like to come by after your visit tomorrow, sir? I'm working, and I'll get you a free cheeseburger, I promise."
"Well, that's really kind of you, Molly. But why?"
"I would like to hear what is going on in San Luis. All those rumours make me curious."
I promised her that I'd come back when I left San Luis. The last 20 miles were a bore. Nothing but blank hills and grey skies. Just a few fellow travellers on the road. Apparently this town was far out, even farther out than I expected. Every now and then I passed a truck, but the closer I got to San Luis, the less often I saw fellow cars on the road. I think I remember that this observation pleased me, mainly because the sound from nearby highways is not a desirable factor on film sets. When I arrived in the village, it struck me that the streets were completely empty. Probably because of the rain, I thought. It was really pouring, so it was hard to find the bed and breakfast the mayor had told me to go to. Hopefully the weather would be better tomorrow, I thought, so that I would at least be able to walk around town. The tour would give me insight into the suitability of the location. While I looked for the B&B the mayor had described to me over the phone, my thoughts went back to the pretty girl at the diner, Molly. Probably an Irish gal, I thought. I remember musing upon her while scanning the empty town's roads for some sight of the bed and breakfast sign. I saw people looking at me from their windows, probably surprised, or maybe even scared, by the sight of a car going slowly past their houses. "Don't worry, folks. I'm no Manson hippie coming to slaughter your pregnant wife," I said to myself. If only I knew back then. I finally found the bed and breakfast at the end of the street. It was a fairly old building, probably dating from somewhere around the 1930s, but well maintained. I got out of my car and walked over to it, passing two primitively made wooden crosses. "Sparky," the one on the right said. The other said, "R.I.P. Miles, a good dog." There was no bell at the house, so I just knocked on the white wooden door. After I knocked again, louder this time, an old lady opened the door. She was skinny as a rail, wearing a black dress which looked like something she'd stolen from a Depression-era movie set. "You're soaking wet," she cried, and urged me to come inside. I welcomed the warmth of her place, and could hear the pleasant chirping of a fire coming from the living room. She introduced herself, but her name too has slipped my mind with the passing years. When I got into the living room, still dripping from walking those few metres from the car door to the house, the woman started on the terrible rain.
"The most dreadful weather we've had in a while," she explained, almost apologetic.
"I'm used to it, ma'am, since I'm from Baltimore," I said.
"Oh my, all the way from busy Baltimore. What brings you to our town, young man?"
I remember thinking that the last time someone had called me a young man was many years ago. I gave her a vague answer on purpose, not really wanting to go into my plans for the second time that day. Then she offered me tea, and I gladly accepted. When she retreated to the kitchen, I checked out her living room. I've always been a curious person, so I tried to get a sense of this old lady through her stuff. I paced around her room, looking at pictures of what probably were deceased relatives, in vintage frames. I also saw a picture of a black dog, which I thought was probably Sparky or Miles, who I'd seen were buried in the front garden. It was a cosy home, decorated with as much nostalgic memorabilia as she could fit onto the many shelves and tables. I noticed that, for some reason, she had taken some pictures down. There were just empty squares on the walls. Weird, I thought, but at least there were no traces of extremist Christianity here. Maybe Molly had exaggerated.
"I heard most people here are decent church-going folk. Is that true?"
I tried carefully, so as not to offend her. The woman chuckled a bit. A strange chuckle it was, but I didn't really think twice about it. She handed me a cup of Earl Grey tea, in an old-fashioned ceramic cup that could only belong to an old lady.
"You could say that, yes," she answered, carefully sipping from her cup. "Some townsfolk are quite fanatical believers, definitely. But tell me more about your job, Mr. Fenton."
While enjoying the warmth of the fire and my tea, I told her about my job and its prospects. She was asking me a lot of questions, and I noticed that she dodged most of mine about the town or her life. When I mentioned the festivities that the mayor had told me about, she just chuckled that strange chuckle again, and looked at me with a half-smile, clearly amusing herself with this secret happening that she knew more about than me. Suddenly, I felt very, very tired. I thought it must have been the travelling. I said I felt sleepy.
"Your room is upstairs, first on the left," the lady said.
I excused myself again and headed for the stairs. I wanted to take a shower before bed, but I suddenly felt so tired I just let myself fall on the bed, not even bothering to take off my clothes. I drifted away instantly. In the middle of the night, something woke me up. I decided to get myself a glass of water because my mouth felt dry, but when I tried to get up, I was unable to move. I felt terrified right away. I tried to move again, but my legs and arms felt like they were made of concrete. I couldn't really feel my body at all. I realised I was paralysed. I started panting. I bit my lip to confirm that I was not having some horrible nightmare. But I wasn't. My eyes were open, and I could still see, but the rest of my body was not responding. Slowly, I was able to see better in the dark as my night vision improved. The sounds of thunder and rain became a horrible soundtrack for that fearful moment in which I had lost all ability to move. I noticed that the door was open, while I was sure I'd closed it before collapsing on the bed. While trying to get my body moving with all of my mental and physical strength, I saw a silhouette standing in my open doorway. Although I couldn't really see her face, I could tell it was the old woman because of her skinny shape. I screamed at her, demanded that she help me, but I couldn't produce a sound. I felt shackled by some invisible force. It was perhaps the most frightening feeling I ever had, to be conscious but at the same time restrained. And all the while I lay there, just trying to force out a sound, but being unable to. The woman just stood there, not really doing anything. She was just staring at me. I felt tears streaming across my cheek when she started to chuckle. I knew she was responsible for this, right at that moment when I heard that odd chuckle, which was no longer weird, but very, very scary. I decided that the only thing I could do was to close my eyes. After a few horrible minutes, the woman stopped chuckling, and I could sense her coming closer. "Don't open your eyes," I said to myself. "Whatever you do, don't open your eyes." I tried, but in the end I failed. I opened them when I could smell her, the scent of old women, that of vintage flowery perfume and dust, an ancient smell. I opened my eyes then and saw that she was bending over me, holding a small cup. She held it over my head and something poured out of it. I couldn't resist and felt how the cold liquid entered my mouth. It didn't take long for the world to turn black again. I woke up no longer in a bed, but rope-tied to a pole. My hands were tied behind my back and I felt wood scratching my spine. I knew it was probably morning, since there was light coming into the space where I was kept. The woman, or maybe someone else, had moved me to a different building. It took me a minute to realize I was being held inside a church. My mum had made me come to a service every Sunday when I was young, but I had never liked church. The vastness and scale of the building seemed to be designed just to make me feel small and insignificant. And then there were the ramblings of the priest, of which I only understood half, if I really tried to pay attention. None of it resonated with me back then, so when I went off to college, I never went to church again. My Sundays centred on girls and sports. And here I was, rope-tied in a fucking church. It was almost ironic, really. The rope hurt my arms, but at least I could feel it. I wiggled my arms and was relieved to find I was able to move again. I recalled the old lady, and a shiver ran down my spine when I thought of her silhouette, there in the dark, just watching me, chuckling. I had a massive headache, like someone had hit me in the head with a brick or something. I realized then that I was probably held in the small church I'd seen when I was driving past the houses the day before. But this church didn't look like the church I went to as a child. The interior wasn't white, or at least it wasn't any more, because everything seemed to be painted black. Even the chairs and the altar were black. I realized that somebody had gone to incredible lengths to paint everything. I was facing the central altar, but all Christian attributes were removed. The only things that weren't altered were the stained glass windows which let in the morning light. I could hear that it was still raining, but it was just a drizzle now. I was the only one in the black church, and I hung there for quite some time, feeling like shit, just wondering what the hell was going to happen to me. I thought of the woman and her remarks on the firm believers in town. She had poisoned me with something, and now I was tied up in this horrible place, far away from help. In horrid anticipation, I waited and waited. It could have been hours before finally a piercing sound filled the church. At first I thought it was a scream, but then I realized it was the sound of a horn, It grew louder and louder, an awful sound, piercing through my aching head like a nail. A large group of people entered the church from behind me and surrounded me. Someone was still blowing that damned horn. Everybody was dressed in black robes with hoods, making it impossible to see their faces. I screamed at them to cut me loose, but none of them reacted to the sound of my voice. Two men came up behind me and then went up the spiral stairs that led to the organ. In the meantime, the rest of the people waited silently. As far as I could see, they were all dressed in the same long robes. I screamed till my throat hurt, but none of them seemed to care. Then, the doors placed in front of the organ were slowly opened by the two men who had climbed the stairs. They revealed something so horrible that even my failing memory can still recall every detail vividly. They had hung up the carcass of some large hairy animal over the organ. Maybe it used to be a bull or a brown bear, I thought. I couldn't tell for sure. The carcass was cut open, hollowed out, and inside the part where once the intestines of the beast had been, they had stuffed the body of an old man. A split second later, I thought he might have been still alive, but his chest was not moving, and his body had turned pale. I only recognized the man after I had stared at that horrible display for a bit. It was the mayor that I had seen in the book. He had somehow become part of this monstrous tableau. I gagged then. I wondered what kind of madness had led to his killing. I screamed, afraid to end up like the mayor. The figures in the robes watched, motionless. After what seemed like forever, my voice became shrill from screaming when I finally gave up. Some of the figures lowered their hoods and started singing. It was high-pitched and sung in a language I didn't recognize. I saw it was just the women singing. Their ages varied. Some of them couldn't have been older than 15. After they finished singing, the women walked up to me, and to my horror, I saw they carried matches in their hands. I started screaming again, because I was afraid that they would set me on fire. But the women stopped a few feet away from me, and all at the same time, lit the candles that were resting on the floor. I hadn't even noticed them before. Then the women walked back. I begged them to help me, but they didn't seem to understand me. Suddenly, they dropped their black robes one by one. Their naked bodies were partly covered with some black substance, and I saw blood running down the legs of one of the women. I screamed again. Then a man came slowly forward, his face partly hidden in his black hood. In his hands he held a copper cup. Two other men followed him. "Drink," he said softly, while holding the cup in front of my face. I shook my head and asked what kind of madness was going on here. He ignored my question and ordered me to drink again. I shouted that I wouldn't. Then the two men behind me came closer and forced open my mouth. I tried to keep my nose shut as well as I could, but I still got a flash of the taste of decomposing meat and soil. I gagged, but one of the men pulled my hair back hard, causing the foul liquid to flow back into my throat until I had swallowed it all. I wanted to puke, but the man with the copper cup made sure I didn't. He struck me with his hand and held my face up. Then everything became dark. The light slowly faded from my vision till there was nothing but blackness all around me. Naturally, I panicked, but then I just decided that I was dead. They had murdered me in some dark ritual, and this was it, just blackness. And nothing more. No tunnel, just endless nothing, like space. It scared me at first, but then I just decided that it was okay, that there was nothing left to be afraid of anymore. It turned out I wasn't dead. Somehow I snapped out of that darkness, and I woke up in front of my car, right where I'd placed it, in front of the bed and breakfast. It was drizzling again, and it was getting dark. I had no idea how long I'd been out. I felt like I'd lived a terrible nightmare, but my wrists were sore, and I could see that some of the black liquid the man had forced me to drink had spilled on my shirt. My wrists still carried rope burns. So that proved that everything I remembered had really happened. I had a terrible headache. My keys were still in my pocket, so I got into the car. A note was taped to the wheel. It said, "Do not come back here ever again. We'll kill everyone if you do, everyone that is dear to you." I threw the paper out of the window and drove away from that horrible place as fast as I could. My headache got worse and I felt so tired I was afraid I would run off the road. I turned the radio up so as not to fall asleep. Black Sabbath blared through the speakers. It got darker outside and I had a hard time focusing on the road, finding my way back to San Francisco. At some point I felt I was going to collapse. I realized then that I hadn't eaten anything for many hours now. I didn't know how long I'd been gone, but I knew I needed to eat something and get some rest. It was the neon sign of the diner I'd been in before that revived me. Exhausted, I parked my car and stumbled toward the entrance. It was warm inside. I lifted myself to a couch with my last strength. Then the young waitress rushed over. It was Molly.
"Oh God, oh God, oh God,"
she screamed again and again.
"What the hell happened?"
But I was too weak to answer. It was as if my body just gave up. Now I was in a safe space again. The last thing I remember is how Molly looked at my wrists, and I remember how the coffee pot she had held in her hands shattered on the floor. The coffee spread like a black stain and ran neatly along the patterns of the tiles. The police questioned me for an hour and a half. I asked them if they had been to San Luis, but none of them seemed to have any knowledge of what had happened in the village. I begged them to go and investigate the church, but they barely responded to my request. They asked about my mental state, whether I was taking medication or had used drugs recently. I could not emphasize often enough that that was not the case. I was abducted and then had to drink some black liquid which I thought to be blood. But every time I repeated my story, it became more clear that the police didn't believe a word of it. Only when I got home could the police tell me more about what they found in San Luis, or actually what they didn't find, because the officer who answered my questions on the phone said they had not found anything strange. I don't exactly remember how he phrased it, but he suggested that I should take some days off work and maybe consider going to a doctor, that it might be reasonable to assume I'd experienced a serious psychosis. But I knew it wasn't that. I was a stable, rational man. There was no history of mental illness in my family whatsoever. I was sure that what I had seen was real, but I didn't dare go back to San Luis. The note I had found had explicitly told me not to, so I just hung up the phone and cried in frustration. The days after my abduction were terrible. I slept badly, and when I got a few hours, I had horrendous nightmares. A recurring dream that I had was so frightening that suicidal thoughts began to enter my mind. In the dream, I was sleeping in my bed. Everything was dark around me. Not just the darkness that the night brings, no, it was a different darkness. At some point in the dream, my door opened. I could hear the creaking and squeaking of the door, but I couldn't move. A black figure stepped inside. It was tall and broad, but not recognizable in the dark. He just stared at me with glowing red eyes. I found myself unable to move, my legs and arms stiff, like I was a corpse. Then the dark shape would come closer and closer. Then he would open up his wide mouth, revealing its sharp teeth. And then he would sink his mouth into my flesh, till I woke up screaming. I spent half of my savings on therapists and psychologists, but none of them could help me get rid of my terrifying dreams. I gathered the courage to truthfully tell one psychologist what had happened to me. Her response was kind, but I didn't know if that was genuine or maybe just professionalism. She eventually diagnosed me with some acute form of sleep paralysis, a common condition that gives people horror-like visions just before they wake up. But I knew there was more to it. It had to do with the ritual. Something dark or evil had entered my body and was now living there. For 4 months, I tried everything the medical and psychological field had to offer, but the nightmares continued to haunt me. Every night I woke up bathed in sweat, filled with fear, and nobody to talk to, nobody to hold. I stopped speaking with the psychologists and took a month off from work. I stayed in bed for days, had my food delivered to me, and kept myself awake with the help of television and amphetamines. But no matter how hard I tried to stay awake, sleep came every time, like a force that lifted up from my stomach and swallowed me up. And every time, whether I fell asleep on the couch or in my bed, the dark figure with the sharp teeth was there. My life became filled with fear. I told my friends that I was doing some work on location in Africa to explain my absence. An easy cover, because my work often asked me to spend weeks abroad. In a city as big as Baltimore, there was little chance that I would bump into them by accident. It was desperation that eventually led me to the city's biggest library. I searched for books about nightmares and read them all. It was astounding how many books were written on dreams. Hundreds of books analysing this odd occurrence of which humankind's knowledge is, even now, only scratching the surface. At some point, I found an old book that referred to specific rituals from New Guinea that were used by ancient tribes living in the rainforest. It was all nonsense, of course, but it interested me nonetheless. Not much later, I got myself some books on witchcraft and magic. I found a corner of the library where it was quiet. I hadn't shaved in days and felt constantly watched by people when I roamed around in public spaces. Maybe it was paranoia, I don't know. But I longed for peace and solitude. I did not know specifically what I was looking for, but I was sure there must be something in those books that could tell me more about what ritual I was subjected to, because I knew for sure that my dreams were caused by it. Even just an anecdote from someone with a similar experience would make me feel less alone. I spent hours reading about witches and magic that day. About 5 p.m. I finally decided I should go home. My mouth was dry and my stomach was empty. I hadn't properly eaten or slept in days. I was walking towards the elevator when I saw a man sitting in a corner by the window. His hair was dyed an artificial black, and I saw that there were scabs on his knuckles, probably caused by a fight, I reasoned. He was reading something, and in front of him there was a stack of books which, apparently, all had dark themes. He was reading up on the occult and witchcraft, just like I was. I stopped and looked at him. He looked pale, like he'd never seen a day of sun in his life. He glanced up at me before returning to his book. I got into the elevator and started thinking, maybe he could help me. Maybe he knew more than I knew. It was worth a shot, I thought desperately. I bought a cup of coffee from a cafeteria downstairs, and then just waited till he came out. 45 minutes later, he finally appeared. I wanted to go to him, ask him about his interests, but I figured that wasn't smart at all. I would probably spook him, so I followed him back to his place. I stood in front of his house for a while, and eventually rang the bell. The man with the black hair opened quickly.
"I know who you are. I saw you in that library," he said with surprise. "Did you follow me? Why were you in the occult section?"
"That's for some research," I lied. "I'm working on a script for a film about a satanic cult." I flashed him my film studio card, but I knew he didn't believe me. I doubt if I would have believed myself. My voice was trembling, and he definitely noticed my tired, bloodshot eyes.
"Can I come in?"
"Why?"
"Can we just talk for a bit?
I noticed you were interested in the subject too. Maybe you can help me. I'm kind of in the dark here, you see. I lied.
I was just going to...
Please, I tried. I really need some help. Just a few minutes of your time. The man sighed, and for a moment I thought he was going to shut the door in my face.
You have to help me. I don't owe you anything, mister. This is all quite unconventional.
Can I come in, please? I just have some questions. The man sighed, and then carefully opened the door, as if he were still not sure about letting me in.
Sit down, the man said compellingly, as I entered his living room,
and I sat down on a Chesterfield. He went to the kitchen, and I heard the ringing of cups and a kettle that was turned on. Only then did I notice a large stuffed raven on the wall. The motionless bird looked over the room threateningly, his artificial eyes gleaming in the light from the television. The bird cast frightening shadows on the wall to which it was attached. I felt strange, but I was glad the man had let me in. The black-haired man returned with two cups of tea. Although I was thirsty, I just let the cup stay on the table, untouched.
"Why are you in the library so often?" I asked. "I like to read on the stuff I'm interested in."
"What stuff is that, exactly?"
"Well, I am a Satanist," the man said boldly. "But before you get scared, you have to understand that I'm not the kind of Satanist who sacrifices virgins and eats bats for fun. Probably no Satanist really does that sort of stuff. Most of us are harmless, keep to ourselves."
"They do exist," I replied.
"How do you know that? As far as I know, most modern Satanists are peaceful and progressive people," the man said.
"The research I do that I told you about, that was a lie. There is no research for a film." The man just stared at me, and in his eyes I saw an alarmed scepticism. He was probably wondering if he had invited a madman into his home.
"I guessed that much. Why are you here?" the man asked coldly.
I told him the story then, as detailed as possible. I spoke about my abduction, the nightmares, and the endless conversations with psychologists, which had led to nothing. He listened carefully, sipping his tea every now and then. He didn't ask questions, just listened. When I was done, he told me that he didn't know if he could help me. I begged him then. I didn't even know if he believed me, but I just needed something from him.
"I can't help you. I know nothing about black magic. In fact, I don't really believe in it. I once did some research on it, but it's all a bunch of crap, if you ask me."
I felt a headache coming on while he spoke. I put hope in this man, but of course it would lead nowhere. But then he got up from his chair with a sigh and walked over to his cupboard, where he took a thick black book with worn edges from the shelf.
"It's probably all bullshit, but this might be useful if you want to know more about ancient black magic," the man said, handing me the book carefully.
I took it and studied the cover. It showed nothing. It was completely covered in worn black leather. I opened it carefully and read the title: "The Artistries of Witchcraft, as Composed by Eleanor Crane and Her Disciples."
"It's a book about curses and how to turn them around. Take it with you. Read it, if that gives you some comfort. But please be careful with it. It's vintage, quite valuable. Return it to me when you're done."
I thanked the man 1,000 times, until he asked me kindly to leave his house. He needed to go to work the next morning. Somehow I was surprised that this strange man apparently had a normal job, just like me. I thanked him again and left. I carried the book under my coat to protect it from the elements while I rushed home. There I put it on my table and read for 4 consecutive hours, deep into the night. I was surprised by the countless horrible curses described in the book. Often they resulted in serious physical inflictions. The book was written in Old English and was in a very poor condition. Some pages were only partially legible or stuck together. I thought it all the more important to handle the book with care. After hours, I found a chapter that was devoted to a curse that was practiced by indigenous tribes in Sri Lanka. I was shocked when I read about it. Almost every detail matched my experience. The book described a ritual in which a liquid made of wet earth, cow's blood, and several herbs was fed to a grown man. This mixture was used to open a gateway from which a demon would spawn. This unholy creature would then taunt the victim forever. The only way to lift the curse was for the accursed to kill another human being. In particular, a weak person that was already close to death physically. When killed, this might cause the demon to latch on to the dying person and thus return to the underworld. It might sound crazy, but I just knew that this was the curse that the people in the Black Church had bestowed upon me. And now I knew how to lift it. Of course, I couldn't really picture myself hurting someone, let alone kill them. But every night, the dark figure came back and haunted me. Fear became the only constant emotion in my life, and I got desperate. So, 2 weeks after I got the book, I was on the brink of insanity. I knew I couldn't live with this fear much longer. I either had to end my own life or try to lift the curse. I decided I was going to try the latter. I waited till it was dark and roamed a bad neighbourhood of Baltimore in search of a victim. I wondered a few times if I wasn't completely going out of my mind. I was about to kill someone, truly out there to actually kill someone. But the thought of seeing that black shape with its long teeth standing in my room was enough to get me to focus. If murder was the only way to stop it, I would do it. At first, I planned to go to the hospital with a knife, maybe kill an old dying person. But I decided that that was way too risky. Those people were closely monitored. So I decided it had to be one of the homeless people on the streets of Baltimore. Most homeless people were in poor health anyway. Lost souls, addicts, and broken minds. The seedy streets of Baltimore had tons of them. They died very often too. Got mugged and killed for a hit. Froze to death in the winter cold, or just OD'd. One more death wasn't going to make a difference. So here I was, walking through the poorly lit streets of Fairfield, a sharpened kitchen knife clutched in my right hand, feeling uneasy but determined. The first person I saw was a skinny man sleeping on a bench. It was perfect, really. He was all alone and looked terrible, his face pocked with several wounds. A meth addict, probably. I approached him slowly, but then he suddenly woke up and started screaming when he saw me approaching. He screamed and screamed so loudly, I almost dropped my knife. I ran away and walked in a different direction. It was quiet on the streets, too quiet almost. I feared that I would get mugged or killed or mutilated. That would be ironic, I thought, like life is. After 30 minutes or so, I saw an old man sleeping in a dark alley. I checked my environment before I got to him, made sure there was nobody around. I stabbed him 4 times. He didn't die like you see in movies. His death was slow. As he spewed blood, I thought of my redemption. I had to, because I felt terrible. But some determined voice in my head told me to stab him again, and then again. The voice told me I had to stab till he was quiet. That evening, I went home and took a long shower. The blood on my hands turned pink before it went to the drain. Afterwards, I fell asleep right away. I woke up the next day at noon. I realized right away that it had worked. I had slept without nightmares. A whole night without the monstrous figure. I couldn't believe it. What I had read in that ancient book had resolved me, but I couldn't say I was happy, because to achieve it I had done something so horrible it replayed in my mind. That same day I brought the book back to the Satanist. He didn't ask if anything had worked. I just thanked him and slipped him a cheque for $1,000. "For your trouble," I said. He was hesitant for a second, but then he took it, and that was the last I saw of him. I never went back to San Luis. It's 28 years now since it happened. Approximately 2 months after I killed an innocent man, I drove back to that diner, just to thank the waitress for her help. After Molly finished college, we got married in California, and we've been together ever since. A lot of people frowned upon our age difference, but I don't care, because she is the only woman I truly feel genuine love for. I have to thank Molly for everything. It is she who kept me on the right track all that time. I drank heavily for a bit, first because of the killing, but also because I saw him again sometimes. But my sweet Molly always stood by me, got me through tough times. She's the only one who knows the truth, the full truth. She knows what I did to that poor homeless man, how desperate I was. I can never forgive myself for that, but I have learned to live with it. We have 2 beautiful children and a dog. Despite my ordeals, I can say I have lived a happy American life. But sometimes, out of the blue, he still appears. Not in my nightmares, but in real life. That dark demon occasionally finds his way back. But he keeps his distance now. Yesterday, I went to the garage to get something, but when I got there, I'd forgotten what. It happens sometimes. Ever since, I'm fuzzy. I saw him there, standing in one of the corners of the garage. He has the shape of a tall man, but his arms seem longer somehow. His nails are like claws. The dark figure just stood there, its face pressed against the wall. It was hard to find in the darkness of the unlit garage, blending in perfectly with the shadows. The figure wears no clothes, has no hair. He is just a dark shape made from shadows. I watched him standing there for a minute. God, what had they put inside my body for me to see everything that's unholy take form? I cried there silently. I always do when I see him, but despite my tears, I'm no longer afraid. Because I know now that the shadows can't hurt me. And I have Molly, God bless her soul. I'll go soon, and I'm happy I'll go before she does. She still has some time, and I know she can manage without me. She is still young and full of life. Maybe she'll find someone for the remaining part of her days. I hope she does. Sweet Molly, I'll miss her. But when I pass, the only thing I pray for is that it will be a place that has no darkness. I've been to hell before, and I don't want to go there again. This story is released under an attribution, non-commercial, no derivatives, 4.0, International Creative Commons license. This story was narrated by Peter Yearsley. It was written by A Darker Tale. Follow A Darker Tale on Instagram for more. Thanks for listening.